Hey, folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear John LaSala, et cetera, so forth and so on. Well, that's actually what John wrote down that I should say about him in the episode instructions, but I think I should add that he is a gargantuanly invaluable part of keeping Risk running as our director of our audio team. And because I love to give you guys the chance to hear from some of the other folks here at Risk working behind the scenes, John is going to host this episode, and JC Cassis, our business director, will be dropping by to deliver the State of the Union of Risk during this episode, too, so don't miss that. And now, here's Johnny.
Thanks, Kevin. But before we get underway, I want to remind everyone about what you said at the end of last week's episode, that the 30th Best of Risk episode is coming, and soon. But before we pick what stories will be on this monumental episode, we want to hear from you, our listeners, our fans, what stories you think should be on the Best of Risk number 30. All of the candidates are listed at risk-show.com/bestofrisk, and you can vote in the poll right there. The voting ends on March 20th at noon Eastern Time, so make haste. And please, come on, no ballot box stuffing. Let's practice free and fair elections while we still live in a democracy. And on that cheery note, let's actually get underway, starting with a preview of one of our storytellers, Josiah Simpson, uttering this episode's namesake.
Time to face the music, but don't, pun intended, right?
Right. We'll be right back. Now, here's the show! This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. And as you heard up top, I'm John LaSala, and this is, me behind me now. I mean, me from 1999, some music I composed for a dance theater show called The Snow Queen, back in the late 20th century, because I am that old. I'm turning 50 next week. Anyhow, this episode is called Face the Music, and just like I am facing my semi-centennial, I've got two storytellers to share with you on this episode, each facing the proverbial music in different ways. On the back half of this episode, we're going to hear that whole namesake story from Josiah Simpson. But first, I want to share a story that Lisa Cooper Ellison told me late last year. And I have been so looking forward to getting her story on the podcast because something of the subject matter is near and dear to my heart, something I didn't know was coming before she started telling me. But more about that later. For now, let's get to it. Lisa, take it away.
When I was little, most of the kids I knew had blankies and teddy bears, but I snuggled up to heavy metal. My earliest memories are of jumping on the couch while my dad's Led Zeppelin II album is playing in the background, Whole Lot of Love screaming so loud in the apartment that everything was echoing. And I didn't just listen to these songs or rehearse these songs. I memorized them and internalized them because I love them so much, but also because I needed these songs for when my parents fought. And they fought a lot. And most of these fights started the same way. Dad would do something stupid, mom would start screaming, but then they would escalate to this point where things were getting thrown against the wall, maybe a glass or an alarm clock or even a guitar. And whenever my brothers and I would hear the clink of the broken glass against the floor or something rolling down the stairs, we would hide behind the couch so we didn't end up being the next thing that hit the wall. And in the dark, we would sing the songs we knew. AC/DC's Big Balls, Motley Crue's Shout at the Devil, Quiet Riot's Metal Health, metal songs were louder than my parents' fights, and the beat was faster than my racing heart when things were being smashed around us. And better yet, I could scream these lyrics while I was outside and rage about everything that was going on, and no one would ever know. And being able to keep this secret made me feel invincible. And after a while, I began to think that if I could just be as badass as my metal heroes, nothing could ever touch me. And I began testing this theory when I was around 8 by jumping off this cliff at a construction site while singing Iron Maiden's Number of the Beast. I did this dozens of times, and I never got hurt. And so when I was old enough to buy my own school clothes, I dressed myself in what I considered the metal uniform. Black band t-shirt, dark jeans, 4 or 5 inches of black jelly bracelets on my right arm because we didn't have spike bracelets at the Claire's in my town. And a peace sign around my neck rather than a pentagram because I wasn't so metal that I was into devil worship. Now, having on the metal uniform made me feel invincible, but it didn't win me any popularity contests. I don't know if it was because I went to this pop music loving high school everybody called Happy Valley High, or if it was because I was always trying to hide my feelings so much, but it always felt like there was this invisible couch between me and everyone else, and I didn't know how to bridge it. That changed a little bit when I met Ivan and we started dating. He was the drummer for the band Anal Babies, and he loved metal as much as I did. And sometimes we would drive down the road with Overkill blasting from the speakers and talk about how it would all get better once we got out of high school. Now, he decided to accelerate that process by graduating in January of 1992 rather than June. And as soon as he was out of school, he ditched our upstate New York hometown so he could move to Louisville, Kentucky and get to know his father while pursuing his heavy metal dreams. When I graduated in June, the most metal thing I could think to do was join him. Now, by the time I get there, our house is the band's practice pad. And instead of having a couch and a coffee table in our living room, we have a 10-piece double bass drum set, Marshall amps, and this rusted coffee can filled with cigarette butts. And as the only non-smoker in the group, I promptly put this on the porch. Now, Ivan's bandmates, Mike and Courtney, they don't just love metal, they make metal. And they talk in arpeggios and drop D tuning, and they refer to books like the Necronomicon. And Courtney, she makes these badass metal faces when she is playing her guitar. You know the one where you jut your jaw and you squint your eyes like you're the baddest motherfucker around? She makes that face. And Mike had carved Slayer with a pentagram in his arm using a razor blade. And here I was, this peace and love and Iron Maiden kid. And there were so many differences between us, it felt most of the time like I was auditioning for the role of friend and never quite getting cast. And sometimes I would miss New York so much, I would wonder if I made a mistake and maybe I should go back. But then I would remember what it was like behind the actual couch and all of the fights, and I would know that I couldn't go back. I had to make this work. So when we score tickets to see Megadeth and Suicidal Tendencies, a few months after I get there, I figure this is my chance. Finally, we are all going to be on the same side of the stage. And I know all the lyrics to all the songs for both bands' latest albums. I just figure I need to do something, you know, a little crazy. Dive off the stage, crowd surf over everyone, maybe join the mosh pit. And I even imagined the looks on their face when I, at 5'3", with thick glasses, skinny as can be, am in the middle of the pit, throwing elbows with everybody else. It was going to be awesome. So on the day of the concert, I'm zipping up my black leather biker jacket, and I notice that there is a tornado warning on the TV screen. It's kind of in red letters, flashing like a heartbeat. I point this out to Mike, and he just waves it away and says, "Ah, don't worry about that. That's just stuff that happens on TV." And then Ivan and Courtney shrug, and so I shrug, fingering, okay, the Weather Channel's wrong. Now, Mike is always our driver, and normally he drives this piece of shit Chevette with a broken stereo. But on the day of this concert, he asks his mom if he can borrow her brand new Saturn, which has an awesome stereo system. So I sit in the back with Courtney, so Ivan can man the tape deck. He puts Countdown to Extinction into it and cranks it up to 10. And it is so loud, the windows are rattling. And we're all singing along as we are going down through the rolling hills of Kentucky. It is a beautiful day. Blue skies above, unseasonably warm, and everybody's having a great time. Except about 30 minutes down the road for our 90-minute trip to Cincinnati, I noticed this cloud up ahead, and it's spanning the horizon and rising up into space. It's a little black on the bottom, and I get this funny feeling. Except funny feelings about clouds are definitely not metal. So I try to push it all in and just sing along with everybody else. But the farther we get down the road, the stronger that feeling gets. And so by the time we get to the site of fatal bus crash sign, which is about halfway through our trip, I'm about ready to jump out of my skin. So when Courtney says, "Look, I jumped so high, I almost hit the roof of the car," and I'm looking over to the left, and she says, "Look, there's a rainbow." And sure enough, to the left, there is a rainbow. But when I look to the right, that cloud I've been watching the whole time, there are these points that are coming down. And one of those points is heading towards the ground. And I'm thinking in my head, holy fucking shit, the Weather Channel is right. And then I calm myself down and I say, that's a tornado. Well, hearing the word tornado, Mike pulls over, we all get out, and we watch that tornado hit the ground and rise back up and hit the ground again. And as it's hitting the ground a third time, another tornado forms right next to it. Thinking, holy fucking shit, I didn't know you could have two tornadoes. But here we are, looking at two tornadoes going up and down, and then eventually a third tornado forms. And that tornado doesn't just hit the ground, it blows up a house. I'm pretty sure I just watched somebody die. Time stops as I am watching this cloud of splinters flying through the air. It's about 5 miles ahead of us, and I don't know if it's moving away or if it's towards us, but I'm pretty sure we need to hide. So as everybody else is watching the tornadoes, I'm casually looking for a place to duck and cover. And I notice this dip in the road that seems like it has some potential, when all of a sudden, these dudes from a nearby trailer park mosey on over. One guy's got a beer in his hand, and he cracks the tab, and he looks at the tornadoes, and then he looks at us, and he says, "Y'all probably want to head towards the drainage ditch off the next exit." And then he takes another swig, and I'm like, that is metal. And also, this dude is the wisest guy that I have ever met, and everybody else seems to agree, because we all get in the car and we race towards the thing he's calling a drainage ditch, which is actually a tunnel underneath the expressway. Now, when we're about 200 feet away, I'm expecting Mike to stop so we can all get out. But he keeps on going. And when he's about 100 feet away, my boyfriend Ivan says, "Dude, you've got to stop." But he just clutches the steering wheel like it's a rosary and says, "But the Saturn, my mom will kill me if something happens to the Saturn." And on the count of three, we all say, "Screw the Saturn." And we all get out, even though the car is still going about 5 miles an hour. Well, by the time we get to this tunnel, he does stop. And because we both want to kill Mike, but we also love Mike, we decide to stand next to the tunnel rather than going inside. And as we're peeking our heads inside, trying to figure out what's going on, someone yells, "Another funnel cloud's headed our way." And all we can do is wait. And so we take up positions. Mike is still in the car. Ivan is between the car and the tunnel. And Courtney and I are flanking the tunnel. And I notice that Courtney has got on her badass metal face. And even though Mike is in the car, still worrying about his mom's damn Saturn, he's got a metal face too. And I was just chewing his thumb like he doesn't have a care in the world as he looks at the sky. And I realize I have not perfected my metal face. So all I do is the best I can, which is to get in my best metal stance. Feet hip distance apart. I've got my arms crossed in front of me. And I've got my face as blank as it can possibly be. And I look up at the sky and I begin to whisper Iron Maiden's Number of the Beast. As I watch the sky go from blue to green to gray to charcoal, and when it gets to a little black, I notice that Courtney's saying, "Oh my God, oh my God," which is pretty normal for Courtney, except now I'm saying, "Oh my God, oh my God," because not only is this cloud black, but it is beginning to spin. And as it continues to spin, it's getting this eye that is forming clearer and clearer. And then it looks like it's beginning to come down towards us. And I realize that we are looking into the vortex of a forming tornado. And it is the most awesome thing that I have ever seen. And it would be a killer way to die, except I'm 18 and I don't want to die. And so this song that I've been singing begins to morph into this little prayer, even though I'm a person who doesn't normally pray. And I just feel myself saying, "Please don't let me die. Please don't let me die." And at first I'm saying this to Buddha because I'd grown up as a Buddhist, but then I sang it to Jesus and Muhammad and Krishna and the metal gods and anybody who will listen as the wind begins to whip and it is coming down. And I am pretty sure this is it. And just when I think we are all done, it's like a finger comes up and pops that cloud, and it breaks open. And there are blue skies above. We look at the sky, and we look at each other, and we nod, and we get into the car. And I let out this breath that I didn't even realize that I was holding, because we're going home and it all worked out. But when Mike starts the car, he doesn't head towards the house. He heads towards Cincinnati, which is not only the direction of the concert, but the storm. And by the time he gets to that exit, it's already dark. And the only light is coming from the lightning bolts that are hitting the ground around us. And I realize that if another tornado comes up, we are not going to know. And all we can do is just sing along to the songs.
1, 2, 3, 4! Every day, I see the same face. I'm from the picture, too. It's in the attitude.
So I begin to sing louder and louder and louder as we head towards the concert. And eventually, we do actually make it. And when we get there, I think it's all going to be okay. Except when I look at the arena, this isn't just any arena. This is the Cyclones Arena. And their mascot is a fucking tornado. And by this point, I don't care if anybody knows I'm scared. In fact, I let them all know how scared I am when I look at that tornado and I say, "Are you fucking shitting me?" And Courtney, she just bumps my arm and says, "Fucking tell me about it, dude." And Ivan puts his arm around me and he drums this little nervous drum beat on my arm. And Mike nods and pets the Saturn as we all head towards the door, walking a little closer together than we did before. Well, when we get inside and I inhale that delicious smell of leather and hear the clink of the chain wallets, I settle down a little bit and we find our seats, which are kind of far away from the stage, but that seems like it's going to be okay. And as Suicidal Tendencies begins to play, I let the music wash over me, and for a few minutes, I forget about the storm that's outside still raging around us. And when Megadeth hits the stage, we all look at each other and we put our devil horns in the air and we all have these badass metal faces, and it is going to be amazing. And I realize it's probably going to be okay that I don't have enough energy to either stage dive or get into the pit. But it's not until Dave Mustaine starts singing Tornado of Souls, and he gets to the part where he's singing about how we're all safe in the eye of the tornado, that our metal faces soften. And we look at each other and we laugh. And I feel the space between us melt. And I realize that the audition is finally over. And maybe there never was one at all. I just know one thing. I'm finally home.
This morning, said forever, I would hold my head up high. Cause I need metal in my life, just like an eagle needs to fly. So I walk outside into the street, from a hole I heard thunder. The guy beside me gave me a beer. He had his fist up in the air and called me brother, said my friends are over there. They call themselves immortals, they're the truest of the true.
Man, I hope you are banging your head to this. Or at least throwing your fists or dual metal horns into the air. This is Man of War. Aren't they amazing? And like, completely ridiculous? Anyway, that was a story by Lisa Cooper Ellison called Eye of the Tornado, named for that line right out of the Megadeth song. As I mentioned, I recorded that story with Lisa late last year, and when she talked about graduating high school back in 1992, upstate New York, loving heavy metal, trying to figure her place in this world, well, it took me back. Same year for me. Upstate, metal, finding a kind of home in music, a babe in the woods. So I had a great time working on Lisa's story, taking the exceptionally rare opportunity to get a lot of loud, heavy metal on an episode of Risk. My thanks and apologies to Kevin. And also my thanks to author, speaker, and trauma-informed writing coach, Lisa Cooper Ellison, for sharing her story. Look her up. She's at Lisa Cooper Ellison on the socials, or just go to lisacooperellison.com and check out her podcast called Writing Your Resilience, for anyone who wants to use the writing process to flip the script on the stories they've been telling themselves. Because when we tell better stories about ourselves, we live better lives.
They can't stop us, let them try. For heavy metal, we would die.
We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Greene from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
And now for something completely different. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Kevin Allison giving you J.C. Cassis.
Hey folks, one thing that we've found in the past few years is that when we give you a peek behind the scenes of us, the staff here at Risk, you guys have been so responsive, especially like last summer when we brought our business director, J.C. Cassis, onto the show to kind of share what was happening with the business of Risk at that point. You guys were so responsive, and we thought we would do that again today. We thought we would invite JC back on the show today to just say, what's been happening with us in the business of Risk recently? So, hello, JC.
Hey, Kevin. Nice to talk to you. And well, you know, I talk to you all the time, but it's nice to talk to the listeners and be back on. I wanted to kind of update everybody because I know last time I spoke to everybody, it was last June and everything was in total crisis and we were almost going under. And the fans really came to our rescue in an incredible way. And we figured they probably would like an update as to how things stand at the moment. So last time, as we told you, the situation was that our Patreon income was down, our advertising income was interrupted for months, corporate workshops weren't coming in, and we weren't touring. So now what's happening is our Patreon income is higher. Thank you all so much. People donated a lot outside of our Patreon last summer, which totally saved our ass. So thank you guys so much. Corporate workshops are happening. We're still not touring since it's still too financially risky and not worth the workload. And advertising income is steady, but it's a lot lower than we'd hoped because of lots of things that are going on in the podcast industry that are outside of our control. So we're in a better place than we were last summer, but we're still not where we need to be financially. We still have a $100,000 budget gap to close. So hopefully we can maybe do that this year and hopefully with your help. So the key thing to understand about what's going on is that the number of downloads a podcast gets determines how much money it makes from advertising. So you could have an episode of a podcast that has 100 ads on it, but if only one person downloads it, you're not making any money. And you could have that same episode of that same podcast with one ad on it, but if 100,000 people download it, you make money. So if a show gets fewer downloads, it makes less money. If it gets more downloads, it makes more money. Now, the problem is there's a lot going on in the podcast industry right now that is decreasing the amount of downloads that every show gets. So here is just a few of some of the terrible things that are happening that we have no control over. So one thing is that Google Podcasts app is going away. So if you listen on that, make sure that you start listening elsewhere. We would recommend the Odyssey app, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Podcast Addict, Overcast, anything that will still be in existence that you can listen to podcasts on. Now, you might notice I didn't say Apple Podcasts, even though that still exists and I personally use it because I personally like it. But one of the other huge things that just happened recently is that Apple Podcasts changed how they measure podcast downloads, and it really hurt all podcast downloads numbers a lot. And it especially hurt shows with big back catalogs like Risk, because what happened is it used to be that if you subscribe to a show on Apple Podcasts and then you stopped listening to it for a while and then you came back to it, Apple Podcasts would download all those episodes of the show that you had missed while you were away. But now when you subscribe to a show on Apple Podcasts and don't listen for a while and start listening again, they don't do that. They only download the most recent episode, not all those episodes you missed. So the majority of our listeners listen to us on Apple Podcasts, and a lot of them don't listen consistently every single week. They come and go. So this change hurt our download numbers a lot, which hurts our advertising income a lot, which makes it harder for us to survive. So if you listen to Risk on Apple Podcasts, make sure you listen to our show consistently every week or two. Try not to to stop listening for more than a couple weeks at a time, if possible. But if you do, when you start listening again, make sure you go back into the show's full feed and download all the episodes you missed, because Apple won't do it automatically anymore. So remember, our show does come out every single Tuesday and Thursday, whether Apple shows you that or not. So don't think we ever stop publishing, because if we ever do that, we'll definitely let you know. So go back and make sure you re-download those episodes you missed. Also, another super, super fun thing for us is that the IAB, which stands for Interactive Advertising Bureau, is going to be updating how they measure podcast downloads soon. And every single time they've done that in the past, it has catastrophically cut down our download numbers and drastically hurt our advertising income. So we're bracing for another devastating blow there. It's just a really hard time in the podcast advertising industry, and that means that shows are shutting down and people are getting laid off left and right. The whole industry is feeling the pain, and it just doesn't seem like it's ever going to get easier. So this means the financial support of our fans is more important to our survival than ever before. We're trying to do whatever we can to lower our operating expenses and create more revenue streams that we own and control, but we need more time and breathing room to get those up and running. So your financial support was actually our biggest income stream last year for the first time in our show's history. And that's partially because our advertising income was unusually low in such a tough year, but partially because you guys stepped up to the plate and donated to us like never before to save us in a terrible time that almost shut us down. Simply put, your financial support is absolutely the reason we're still here, and we really want to thank you from the bottom of our hearts for that, because we just could not do this without you. So, as I mentioned, this year we need to close a $100,000 budget gap to break even, and we need to do even better than that to do more than just scrape by. And we have a lot of ideas as to how we're hopefully going to do that. We're relaunching the Story Studio website because it hasn't been working properly for the last many months, and we're hoping to have a lot more storytelling classes and corporate workshops up and running. We're regularly running our new What's Your Story event in New York, which has been a big success so far, and which we specifically invented partially to help us get through this time. We're also going to be revamping our Patreon to make it more of a place that you're excited to be, to connect with the Risk team and Kevin, to maybe even attend story recording sessions, to attend storytelling open mics in salons, to pitch us your stories live and get feedback in real time. We want to make it a place that you want to come to connect with us and other Risk listeners in ways that are just fun and enriching for you. So if you have any ideas about what you want us to do over there that would make you excited to join, definitely let us know. We're working on totally new ideas. Like, a fan of ours who has a travel company approached us and said, hey, why don't you do an intimate international travel experience for some of your biggest fans to celebrate the show's 15th anniversary this fall? And that sounded like an awesome idea and also a good way to make some money. So we are working on that and we'll be announcing more about it soon. So if you have a business or something that you do that you could work with us on to help us raise funds and engage with our fans, we always want to hear those ideas. And you can just tell us at kevin@risk-show.com anytime. We're considering also doing a big online fundraiser like a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo if possible. But last year, when I talked to you guys about all this financial trouble that we were dealing with, people donated so generously without us having to do a formal fundraiser that we didn't need to do it. And that saved us a lot of work and trouble. So if you guys can do that again, that'd be pretty sweet. And one other big thing you can do to help us survive is hire the Story Studio for corporate storytelling workshops. If you work somewhere that hires companies to train your staff, hire the Story Studio for your next training. We'll improve your team's presentation skills and public speaking skills, help you figure out how to tell more compelling stories in your work, and help your team feel closer to each other as people. One of our clients even said that we brought a $900,000 return on investment with the training that we gave them. So it's just good business to hire the Story Studio.
Yeah, so there is a lot going on. You guys might have seen some of your favorite shows go away already. You might have seen some of the reports in the news about the industry just being rocked by monopolization and just all this technical behind the scenes business of how downloads are counted and all the craziness. So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we really are so dead set determined to buck the trends and keep on keeping on. And it is your guys' passion for the show that keeps our passion for the show fueled. So, yeah, we do have to thank you so much. And we do hope you'll continue helping us out.
Yeah. And for any of you who don't remember where to go, it's risk-show.com/support for all the options, or you can go straight to patreon.com/risk or paypal.me/risk show to donate. And no amount is too small, and certainly no amount is too big. Last year, we had amounts everywhere from like $5 to, I think our biggest donation was $3,000, which just blew us away. But every donation means so much to us. It costs about $1,000 a day to run Risk. So whatever you give, just think, you know, oh, I'm getting 5 more minutes of the Risk team working. I'm getting another day of Risk working. I'm getting another week of Risk working, or whatever. It just, it takes a lot to keep this thing going, and you guys are doing it for us, so thank you so much. We have seen a lot of our friends with storytelling shows throw in the towel over the last year. So many people are just saying, I'm burned out, there's no way to make money anymore, I don't have any time to do this if I'm going to make a living. And indeed, you know, over the last year, we've been telling our team, hey, if you need more income, you got to get a side job, because we can't provide that, you know, and that's been really hard to deal with. But we're determined to keep this going, even if everybody's working part-time. But the more support we have from our fans, the easier it'll be to keep going. And we'd like it to be a little bit easier than it has been, if possible.
Yeah. And another thing is that if you do just want to chat with us about any of these sorts of things, JC and I both see all the emails that go to kevin@risk-show.com.
Thank you, Kevin. And of course, thank you, JC, for that look under the hood of Risk Operations. But most especially, thanks to you listeners for helping keep us afloat. We really are struggling, everyone here on the team. And it means the world to us when you give us that helping hand. Now, moving on. Next, we're going to hear from Josiah Simpson. This is a story that's been hanging around here in our archives for several years. Josiah first told this story during one of our live stream shows back during the pandemic lockdown, but the audio quality was just so poor, we were really kind of loath to put the recording on the podcast. But I loved the story, so I reached out to Josiah recently and asked him to re-record it with me, with a decent mic this time, and I'm so glad he obliged. So, Josiah, tell them what you told me.
So the year is 2010. I am on my first journey through college as a music major, absolute woodwind lover, clarinet and saxophone. I come to the realization towards graduating that my aspirations of becoming the principal player of a symphony or a larger orchestra, not as realistic as I was originally thinking. Attaining that height in that realm is kind of similar to a college basketball player making it to the NBA, right? It is kind of that difficult next leap. Faced with this realization, I start looking at other options and soon discover that the United States military branches is one of the largest employers of musicians in the entire country. Shocking. I jump at that, right? Okay, there's a chance to travel, all this good stuff. Sounds great to me. Sounds bewildering to my friends and family when I tell them about this idea. They were just like, you're doing what? A little bit of a dog head tilt or moment there for sure. But I look into it more and I tell them more about it, and everyone's sold. It sounds amazing. So I quickly have an audition with a recruiter. He loves what he hears, and I am slated to go off to basic training. And a couple months later, I am headed down to Fort Benning, Georgia with a bunch of infantry people, and I am running through the woods in camouflage. It's awesome. Soon after basic training, all the musicians get sent to the Army School of Music, they call it, in Virginia Beach, where thankfully I am now meeting other musicians, not just infantry-minded individuals, and have a great time at music school, graduate there, get sent off to our first duty stations. This whole time, though, I just have this feeling of not quite fitting in. It's an environment I am very much not used to, filled with people that I'm just very much not used to being around. When I get to my first duty station, though, I meet this trumpet player named Vicky, and she is just this absolute breath of fresh air, and she's kind of this way for me into this military organization where I wasn't feeling like I belonged. Vicky kind of made me feel like I did. And so our relationship took off very quickly. We're very passionate, of course, about the same things, both being musicians, classically trained, wonderfully talented individual. So we ended up dating for a couple of years. We had a lot of fun. It's enjoyable to be around other musicians, partying on the weekends, etc., etc. Eventually, though, I do get to a point where my drinking seems to be accelerating just about every weekend that goes by. It seems to be increasing. This is, of course, not something that I am noticing. Fresh out of college, being young, totally normal, right? Almost any amount. It's just something that, oh, it comes with the territory, especially if people know about the culture of the military. Very booze heavy. Vicky, however, had a little bit of family history of alcoholism, so she was much more attuned to, I guess, the signs, the symptoms, things that you would notice about drinking kind of spiraling into that problematic area. So she was pointing these things out to me, but again, I was very much resistant, very much brushing her aside, saying, it's just part of the cult. This is where we are. We're in the army. We're young. It's just a natural part of a weekend. Eventually, drinking takes its toll on me as I start to become, let's say, less stable, a little more paranoid, not such a great partner. And I become very distrusting of Vicky. Not that I really had much reason to be, but I get to a paranoid enough state that I decide that I need to check her text messages. Which, conveniently, we had access to each other's text messages, and it always ends well. So I pull open these text messages, not really expecting necessarily to find something. I don't know what I was thinking I was going to find in these messages. Turns out, though, the first thread that I open is between her and my commanding officer, who was in charge of my musical group. This was a higher ranking guy that I've been working with for probably the past year that was essentially my direct supervisor. The text messages revealed not only a flirtatious dynamic, not only a little bit of a romantic relationship, but an actual euphemism for anal sex. They had gotten to fifth base, as they called it, which I'm learning in the moment. So I am, of course, at this point in time, reading these messages, I kind of see red and any last vestige of stability kind of flies out the window at that point. I'm irate. I decide that these two are the worst people on the planet. They're doing the worst thing on the planet, and they need to get in trouble for this. So my next brilliant idea is to copy these text messages and bring them to not just a couple people in my unit, but my entire command team, which would be my first sergeant, my executive officer, commander. They all needed a copy in my brain. They had to read this. So I deliver them the text messages, and unfortunately, according to Army regulations and brains wiser than mine at that moment, they weren't technically doing anything wrong. They weren't actually in the same group. He was my supervisor, but not hers. And all of this was pointed out to me. Not that I was very receptive to this news, but unfortunately, that is how things played out. At this point, I am saying fully, fuck it, what do I have left to lose? This is when I jump into my 2011 Dodge Charger, which, yes, I bought brand new with my Army enlistment bonus. Please, I know. I already know, y'all. I drive it over as quickly as I can to the local Motel 6, and I check in to one of their lovely corner seedy suites. And I am just sucking down cases of Budweiser faster than any human should be able to. I am munching on really low-grade pizza, and I am watching HBO reruns over and over again in this dark little sad corner. But you know what? It's my dark little sad corner, and I'm loving it there. I am just soaking everything up. I'm in my boxers. I'm eating pizza crusts. Life is good, right? Unfortunately, people start to worry about you after you've been gone for some time. I'm laying around in my beautiful boxers, eating my beautiful pizza crust, when the hotel door is destroyed by this little battering ram and these god-awful police officers. Sunlight pours into my beautiful golem cave and just destroys my eyes. And I'm just standing there with pizza crust in my mouth, wondering, what's going on, guys? Turns out these are Fayetteville police officers. They quickly identify themselves, and they say, you've been missing. You know, your mother filed a missing persons report. I was, what? Dazed and confused. So, according to standard procedure, they were there to take me back to Fort Bragg, now Fort Liberty. So they both go to take me on the shoulder and lightly guide me to the police cruiser. But it's at this moment that something terrifyingly warm is dripping down my leg. And I'm hoping against hope that it's not what I think it is in this moment. But down I look, and there, in fact, I am shitting myself in front of two uniformed officers in a way that I had never experienced before. I didn't know defecation could be this way. It's awful, y'all. Free-flowing. It was terrible. And so, of course, I just kind of look at them dumbfounded. They're a little caught off guard. And very graciously, they said, you know what? You can go in the bathroom and clean yourself up a little bit first before we take you back. Thinking back, that was probably as much for their police cruiser as it was for the sake of my own bottom and dignity. Let's be real. But I was still very grateful nonetheless. So in the bathroom, I go to clean myself up to get into my chariot when I catch my reflection in the mirror and I am just absolutely horrified by what is staring back at me. It had been days since I had seen my own reflection. I hadn't even thought about it or realized it. If you've never seen what a drinking binge can very quickly do to your face, your skin, your just about everything, it takes a toll so quickly, y'all. Oh my God, the creature that looked back at me. Rock bottom moment, indeed. So they take me back to Fort Bragg, where my command team is, of course, less than excited to see me and less than thrilled with my decision-making. Which they let me know in no uncertain terms and at a very high decibel level. Okay, look, despite all this, we can still work with you, okay? Just please don't run away again, okay? Just stay put. My very pickled brain at this time decides, well, running away again would be the best of ideas. Y'all are insane! So here we go, AWOL to Electric Boogaloo. It's the sequel, y'all. Here I am on a plane headed to New Orleans, feeling wonderful, right? I'm going to the best place to drown your miseries, New Orleans, the Big Easy. It's Mardi Gras, everything is awesome. There are parades, there are beads everywhere. I'm sucking down bourbon, I'm sucking down beer. There are drive-through margaritas, everything's awesome. This was, in fact, a wonderful decision. Certified. So I head back to my hotel room. I re-enter my golem cave. Very quickly, though, I am running out of money. But everything's going to be okay, because today is payday. Uncle Sam is going to deposit some money into my checking account, just like he does every 2 weeks. And the booze train can keep on a-chugging, y'all. Let's go. 3 o'clock comes. That's when my deposit usually hit. Nothing. 5 o'clock. It's okay. Maybe I'm in a different time zone, right? Something's just a little bit off, but it's still gonna come. A few more hours go by. Nothing's happening. The next day goes by, and I'm starting to worry a little bit. I only paid for my hotel through this night. This is my last night. I need this money. Keep checking my account. I'm checking. Eventually, I get worried, so I start to do a little bit of Google foo, and I quickly discover that when you leave the military without permission and you stop doing your job, they stop paying you money. Ridiculous, I know. But that is what happened to poor old me in New Orleans. Cut off by Uncle Sam. Oh my God. So I'm in my room. I'm just hanging out. I am drinking my Bud Light that I just had with my room service meal a few hours ago. It was a steak dinner. I mean, you can't skimp on things like that. Come on, y'all. We're in New Orleans. It's vacation. There is a knocking on my door. Ugh. Motel 6 had just happened, right? So it sent me scurrying. I was like, please, God, no, not more authorities. Under the hotel bed I go. I decide I'm going to hide there and let whatever the danger is pass. Very quickly, what I assume was the hotel manager lets these cops in. They come into the room. I hear them looking around. They're murmuring slightly. And for just a moment, I feel like I might just be the luckiest guy in all of New Orleans. They don't see me anywhere. Of course, one of them in the corner, I hear go,
check under the bed.
Oh, how my stomach sank, y'all. All of them seem to look under at the same time, and I am just seeing three or four faces all just looking at my dumb mug, clutching a Bud Light bottle under a hotel bed, looking back at them with a very goofy smile on my face. They grab my legs, they pull me out from the bed, they bring me downstairs, and lo and behold, I am thrown in the back of another police car. And now on my way to New Orleans County Jail, which, if I thought other jails were an experience, oh my good God. Just one huge open bay with bunk beds as far as the eye can see, and a giant row of toilets, and just so many people. So there I had the absolute privilege of going to the bathroom in front of other people and also drying out from what was just an absolutely ridiculous drinking binge, y'all. I don't know if drink like a fish even covers it. So eventually I get my phone calls and I'm reaching out to family with the hands clasped, like, please come help me. I'm out of money at this point. My wallet has been lost at some point in the fray. I am in dire straits. And of course, my family's a little less than thrilled to hear from me after putting them through a very, very difficult and heart-wrenching experience, to put it mildly. But my dad, the wonderful, wonderful person that he is, agreed to fly down to New Orleans to come rescue poor, poor old Joe. And this meant a lot to me because my dad and I have not ever had the closest of relationships. He left when I was like 6. He was more of like weekend dad. And because of that, we just never really formed that deep parent-child relationship. But at the same time, when he walked in and I saw his face, like, none of that mattered in that moment. It was just my parent was there and I was overjoyed and literally, but like, there were tears streaming down my face. And I was that little kid in that moment. And I was so thankful that my dad had come to rescue me. So Dad, very lovingly, brings me back to North Carolina, where it's time to face the music, but don't, pun intended, right? No more running, it's time to go back. I return to base, I somehow steel myself to walk back in front of my commander and my command team after just, I don't know how you could embarrass yourself any more than that, but I get back in front of them, I say what I need to say, I tell them that I'm, you know, moving forward, getting help, getting counseling, and working on the drinking problem and all this stuff. And eventually we come to a kind of a place of understanding, if you could call it that, where we at least both agreed that we wanted me out of the military as quickly as possible. It was time. I was literally at the end of my 4-year enlistment anyway. I'm like, I need to go. And they're like, you need to go. So that was nice that they were able to help me kind of out process quickly. And I was able to move on to the next chapter of my life. And this new chapter involved going back to school to become an English teacher. And despite the trepidation I had for moving on from what I thought was my calling, my destiny, going through the process of working with high school students felt so meaningful and real to me in a way that I hadn't really experienced before as a musician. And looking back, I realized that so much of what I thought about my aspirations as a musician, I was actually doing these things because of what I thought others were expecting of me, right? And sometimes at a young age, when we show promise in some area, we just kind of grab onto it and run with it, and we decide that that's what we're going to do. It's so difficult at that point to know whether or not that's something that's going to pan out, or whether you may have to try different avenues. And at that point in my life, I was convinced that music was this avenue. One of the most meaningful aspects of being an educator and working with especially high school age students is that I encounter other individuals going through processes and traumas and things that are so similar to what I went through at this really young, vulnerable age where we are forming our identities. Being able to help guide them through that as someone who, as y'all are now aware, is very much understanding of how tumultuous and difficult a process that can be. But also how much we can come through on the other side, no matter how difficult and tumultuous a process that was. And so I feel like I have finally landed in a place that fulfills me fully and in this wonderful way. And I am able to give back in a way that's super meaningful to me. And so it means everything to me to be able to share that with you all.
This is Risk, and this is Sanctuary by Frank Tekeli behind me now. It's just one of a dozen different pieces for Symphonic Wind Ensemble that we heard supporting that story by Josiah Simpson. You know, it's conceivable that Josiah could have performed clarinet or saxophone in any or all of those pieces during his time as a musician. Though I suspect his tenure with the U.S. Army Band might have been a bit more Sousa-heavy. But I'm really happy for Josiah for having finally found his calling, even if it wasn't in music. And even if he had to hit rock bottom first to find it. But heck, we should all be so lucky, eh? I find myself often wondering if I'm on the right path, if I'm where I'm supposed to be. Like Josiah, I thought making music was my calling. I mean, I think it is. And yes, I still make music, occasionally even for Risk. But it's more a part of the thing than the thing, you know? So, yeah, congrats to Josiah for having figured his thing out while he's still young. For some of us, I guess it can be a lifelong quest. And if you've got a story to share about your own what-the-hell-am-I-supposed-to-be-doing journey, pitch it to us, risk-show.com/submissions. Let's get your story on the podcast or on the stage. You know, we've got a live show tonight, March 19th, in LA, and one on Thursday, the 21st, in New York City. And more opportunities in the future. Just go to risk-show.com/live to find out where and when. Hey, it's John LaSala. Back one more time to tell you just two things before we go. First, this is more of me behind me, more of that Snow Queen music. Second, you'll be getting Kevin back in full very soon, starting on Thursday when he'll present an episode called The Best of Secret Stories. And I'd love to tell you what all is on that episode, but I've been sworn to secrecy.
But don't.
And then next week, Kevin will host a real teaser of an episode for all of you listening on our free ad-supported feed. It's Patreon Picks number 4. That'll be just a sampling of some of the stories that normally only our patrons get to hear. But that's next week. Whereas today, well, today's the day. Take a risk.